The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, August 31st, 2016. Hi, I'm Todd Zwillick, and you can join me tomorrow for a global town hall on the U.S. presidential election. Head on over to thegreenspace.org. That's GREENESpace.org tomorrow at 12 p.m. Eastern to watch the discussion live. I'll be joined by a bunch of panelists, and we'll be taking questions from people watching around the world. Again, join this global town hall tomorrow, September 1st at noon Eastern, by visiting thegreenspace.org. See you there. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. We thank you so much for listening. The Islamic State says its chief spokesman, Muhammad al-Adnani, has been killed in an airstrike in the Syrian town of Aleppo. It's just the latest headline from a 5.5-year civil war in Syria. Earlier this month, people were horrified by the picture of a small boy who had been pulled from the rubble after a Syrian military airstrike bombed his home in Aleppo. That photograph sparked renewed interest in helping the Syrians still in that country. But aid to Syria might not be going to the best places. A new analysis from The Guardian shows that the United Nations has paid tens of millions of dollars in contracts to businesses and groups closely connected to the Syrian government or President Bashar al-Assad. A lot of this money goes to companies and individuals blacklisted by the United States and EU sanctions against the Syrian government. Now, the UN says that working with those businesses is necessary and that working with the Assad regime is necessary. Unfortunate compromises in a country where civilians need help. Meanwhile, other agencies working in Syria have spoken out. They've said the payments are aiding the Assad regime, which has killed hundreds of thousands of its own people in that country's civil war. Reynold Leenders is associate professor in international relations and Middle East studies at King's College London. And in an op-ed in The Guardian, he called the UN's aid in Syria morally bankrupt. Reynold, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
You've spoken out strongly, and we'll get to that, but how important is it for the UN to be able to send humanitarian aid into a war zone like this, even if they have to deal with an unsavory government?
Well, it's tremendously important. Syrian crisis has brought about a humanitarian catastrophe of enormous proportions. There is an enormous need for humanitarian assistance, both in regime-held areas and in opposition rebel-held territories. So in that context, it's inevitable that you have to make some compromises, but it's important that you strike the balance right. And I think over the last 5 years, since the start of the war in Syria, the UN agencies have not gotten this balance right.
Is there evidence that this money is actually helping to prop up the Assad regime? In one case, millions of dollars have gone to fund blood banks, which are necessary, but now it's revealed that those blood banks are under control of the Syrian military.
I'm not too pleased with that example, because at the end of the day, you know, the state, the regime, has a monopoly on these blood banks. That's unfortunate, but there's very little the UN can do about that. But there are other sectors where UN agencies have been doling out contracts, very lucrative contracts, to Syrian suppliers. Providing humanitarian goods and services that could have easily been purchased from other sources. And these same benefiting companies are owned by senior regime incumbents.
So you've referred to these arrangements as morally bankrupt, and that's a heavy charge because the UN itself says it recognizes that there are bad actors in the government and on the ground, but that civilians need help. It's a war, and in these cases, they have to deal with people who, in better circumstances, they wouldn't want to deal with. But the charge morally bankrupt kind of goes to another place.
Yes, it certainly does. It doesn't come out of nowhere, and it's not just based on what I found in terms of these procurement decisions. The procurement decisions come against the context, a history of 5 years of the UN cozying up to the regime in a very disturbing manner. It involves the human resource management, whereby regime incumbents, relatives of the very same people who are responsible for humanitarian violations and the catastrophe still unfolding in Syria, to use these relatives and give them a job in UN agencies in operating from Damascus. UN agencies have allowed the regime to redact documents, needs assessments, and so on and so forth. And these revelations about procurement decisions come on top of all these failings, in my view. It's inevitable that UN agencies have to make concessions and have to find a balance to work in a complex situation like this. And sometimes they have to deal with unsavory characters. That's inevitable, both on the regime side and the opposition side. But just to systematically dole out, hand out very lucrative contracts to people who are widely known to be straight into the regime or linked to the regime, who are on sanctions list in the United States and in Europe, that is just not done.
One of the complaints that UN officials have had after all of this scrutiny is that when there have been attempts at more transparency, more scrutiny within Syria, that the Assad government just threatens to cut off the aid altogether. Don't get too close to this or else nobody gets anything. That's an awful threat, but people have said that that's what's at play here.
The Syrian regime is playing it very hard, is imposing a lot of demands and threatening and what have you. And they've done that since the start of this aid relationship in 2000 and early 2012. But there are some limits you have to put there. You can't just give in to every single demand that the regime is presenting to the UN. And frankly, I think the UN agencies have been underestimating their own leverage vis-a-vis the regime, because at the end of the day, the regime is dependent upon the UN agencies as well for the provision of humanitarian aid in the areas that it controls. So to my knowledge, there has never been, the UN agencies have never used their leverage in order to get a better deal out of this.
Reinhold Leenders has been a stark critic of UN aid efforts in Syria, which he and many other critics say are aiding and abetting the Assad regime. He's associate professor in international relations and Middle East studies at King's College in London. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, as we've heard there, the United Nations can find itself in a position where it distributes aid into conflict zones, even while making those compromises in who it deals with. Civilians need help, but many critics argue that aid like this, whether from the UN or other international organizations or NGOs, don't necessarily promote stability in those countries. James Robinson is the director of the Pearson Institute for the Study and Resolution of Global Conflicts at the University of Chicago. James Robinson, welcome.
Hello.
First, your assessment of the situation in Syria and how the United Nations has been distributing aid.
Well, my impression, I'm not an expert on the details of it, but my impression is that, you know, this is just business as usual. I mean, this happens all the time, this type of thing. It's just built into the kind of schizophrenic architecture of the aid industry.
So as we pull back then from the criticisms of the UN in Syria and the Assad regime, there's a broader concern here that in the micro sense, of course, aid helps people who need aid. But when you draw back, it may not be helping end the conflict. It doesn't promote stability.
I think that's right. I mean, if you look at some of the main documents which everybody signed up to with respect to foreign aid, such as this Paris declaration of 10 years ago, the first clause in the Paris Declaration says ownership. It's aid is about ownership. What does ownership mean? Ownership means the Assad government get to set the priorities. There are development partners, except the Assad government isn't interested in developing its country or raising the welfare of its citizens. And that's true in most poor countries.
So are there other examples then of places where this type of aid has gone in, but the regime in charge or the despot or dictator who's running the government simply uses it for their own purposes.
Well, I mean, a wonderful contemporary example would be Rwanda. You know, if you look at the World Bank webpage, you'll find the World Bank is giving millions of dollars in agricultural support to Rwanda at the moment, a country where the dictator, Paul Kagame, just rewrote the constitution so he could stay in power forever, which is basically run by the army, an army responsible for probably hundreds of thousands of deaths in Rwanda and the eastern DRC. And what's happening in the rural sector? What's happening is forced cultivation of crops, forced corporatization of the people. You know, it's just a sort of egregious violation of people's rights and democratic principles, and it's all being funded by international donors and all for the benefit of consolidating the authority of the Rwandan Patriotic Front.
Is there a better way to do this in places like Congo or like Haiti, like Syria, like Rwanda? There isn't a case for not helping starving or homeless people. That has to be done. What can be done further out so that all of the aid and comfort, or at least some of it, doesn't go to a dictatorial government?
I think you're right. I think as this discussion of Syria focused, you know, there's just very difficult trade-offs. I don't blame the people on the ground in Syria. You know, they're trying to get the stuff to the people who need it. And, you know, and they're functioning in this international environment which pretends that the whole business is apolitical. You know, this is one of the big problems, I would say, that yes, there are always these difficult trade-offs. But the first thing you have to recognize is the problem of poverty and underdevelopment and conflict is political. It's a fundamentally political problem. You know, if you look at the Articles of Association of the World Bank, it specifically says the World Bank can't do anything about politics. It doesn't care about politics. It doesn't look at the regime or who's in charge. And, you know, and in a fundamental sense, I'd say, you know, thinking about the political science of this, you know, we live in a world which is very Hobbesian. You know, Thomas Hobbes, who wrote in the 17th century, sort of said there's this thing called the state. And the state is legitimate, and it tries to exert authority and establish a monopoly of violence. And, you know, the world system is very Hobbesian today. Whoever it is who's in charge in Kigali or Kinshasa, you know, or Damascus or whatever it is, we regard them as the legitimate government. You know, we give them a seat in the United Nations. They have an ambassador in Washington. And we give them aid and money and support. And, you know, we somehow ignore the reality of the regime and what it's trying to do. And that's very fundamentally in the DNA of a lot of the international aid system, and that needs to change.
Possession on the part of these dictators and despotic governments so often means that aid that goes in goes right to their bottom line and contributes to political instability that was there at the beginning of the conflict. James Robinson is the director of the Pearson Institute for the Study and Resolution of Global Conflicts at the University of Chicago. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
At the Nacional in Havana, a taste for easy living and an eye for a pretty face. Havana, Cuba. Someday, as easy as dreaming, you'll be there.
Travel definitely does not sound like that anymore. 1958 and a travel log there from Pan Am, an airline built on the idea of luxury travel to the frontiers of the world. That is not what flying sounds like for the most of us these days. But as easy as dreaming, in 1958, it was that easy to get to Cuba. But Pan Am regular flights from Key West to Havana and all other flights to Cuba, of course, stopped cold after the Cuban Revolution. Now, with relations warming between the U.S. and Cuba, today, JetBlue Flight 387 is scheduled to take off from Fort Lauderdale in Florida and touch down in Santa Clara, Cuba. It's the first regularly scheduled commercial flight from the United States to Cuba since 1961. Other airlines are lining up for this business, too. New dollars are on their way to Cuba, but not everyone is pleased. Carlos Air left Cuba without his parents at the age of 11 in 1962. He was one of 14,000 Cuban children airlifted to the United States by Operation Peter Pan. Today, he's a professor at Yale University and author of Waiting for Snow in Havana. It won the National Book Award in 2003. Carlos Hare, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, you are one of the people who came out of Cuba right at this time when it was basically sealed off from the United States. Those days are ending. How do you feel about that?
Well, I would feel a lot better if anything was changing in Cuba that needs to be changed. But in fact, things have become worse for Cubans since December 17th, 2014, when the change in policy was announced. So I'm not very happy about this.
This is a time now, as I mentioned, when American dollars and American tourists could be pouring into Cuba. That money seems like it should be a good thing for their economy.
But it won't be, because the military owns the entire tourist industry. So every dollar, every euro that a tourist spends in Cuba goes straight into the pockets of the military junta that runs the place. And the money does not trickle down.
What about the jobs in Cuba, hotels, restaurants, places for all these new tourists to stay?
It's scandalous. The hotels in Cuba, or most of them, are run by European companies, mostly Spanish. And now there's one American-run hotel run by Sheraton. Here's the deal. The employees get high wages, much, much higher than ordinary Cubans get in other jobs. As a matter of fact, they come close to having European wages and American wages, but they are taxed at a rate of 92%. All you can take home if you work in a hotel is between $20 and $30 a month. They won't see the money the tourists are spending.
Carlos Ayer, the thinking among a lot of proponents of this opening, ending the embargo between the United States and Cuba, is that policies like this won't be long for this world once Cubans are exposed to the American economy. That, yes, in the first couple years, these types of policies will persevere, but eventually they won't, because Cubans will demand from their government better treatment. Do you buy that?
No, not at all. It's a fallacy to make this argument that the presence of Americans will change things for Cubans. Cubans have been hosting millions of tourists from Europe especially, but other parts of the world, especially Canada. Last year, Cuba hosted 3 million tourists, mostly from Canada, 1 million from Canada, and 2 million from elsewhere. They've been in contact with Europeans for 10, 12 years. And nothing has changed. Nothing. No, most people who make these arguments have no idea what it is like to live in a totalitarian state where everything is very closely controlled. Repression has increased since the so-called opening, which I prefer to call the normalization circus, because it is a circus. Nothing has changed in Cuba. At the last meeting of the Communist Party Congress, it was made very clear nothing is going to change.
At the same time, Carlos Ayer, one of the undeniable facts here is that 56 years or whatever it is of embargo haven't changed anything either. The Castros famously are still in power, and people wonder what is the advantage of continuing a policy that clearly hasn't dissuaded the Cuban authorities from what they were doing for all these many years.
That's another fallacy, to think that the embargo has not worked. The purpose of the embargo has never been to change the regime. Purpose of the embargo is to contain the damage that a rogue nation can do to the United States. What the embargo means, actually, is Cuba has to pay cash for everything it buys from the United States. They can buy as much food as they want from the United States, as much medicine, and even some products, but they have to pay cash, no credit. People who say, let's lift the embargo, what that means, for practical purposes only, is let's give Cuba credit. I get very annoyed by these arguments that people make that are based on false knowledge of what the situation is in Cuba.
You sound like one person, Carlos Ayer, who won't be going back to your native island. I wonder if that's
true. I can't go back, even if I wanted to, and I don't want to, but I can't. I'm an official enemy of the state, and all of my books are banned in Cuba. It's that kind of place. And most people don't realize this. You know, Madonna goes there and dances on a table and they think everything is fine. But if you live there as a Cuban, life is hell. There's no freedom. There's no freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly. You can't even form a labor union. These poor people who work in the hotels, and that is the best any Cuban can hope for. There are doctors who work in hotels because they can make more working in a hotel than as a doctor. Because you sometimes get tips. You can sometimes bring extra food home. Most Americans, I would say 99.9% Americans, even the ones who travel there, because when they travel, it's basically an apartheid system and people don't really mingle with people, are not aware of the fact that none of the freedoms, none of the human rights that we consider sacred in this country are available to Cubans.
Regularly scheduled American flights are taking to the skies today, bound for Cuba for the first time since 1961. A lot of people see that as a new beginning. Not Carlos Eyre, who is a Cuban exile himself, came to this country at age 11 and says he is an enemy of the state back in Cuba. Carlos Eyre, author, professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick, and it's the last day of the month and a deadly marker for the city of Chicago. August will become the deadliest month in nearly 20 years for that city. 78 homicides and over 400 people shot. Last week, another high-profile shooting in Chicago. 32-year-old Nakia Aldridge, a mother and cousin of basketball player Dwayne Wade. Donald Trump responded to that death on Twitter by saying Aldridge's death proved that African Americans should vote for him. He issued condolences for the death a couple of hours after that. But residents in Chicago are desperately wondering what can be done to de-escalate the violence on the south and west sides of their city. Joining me now is Aisha Jaco. She's the co-founder and current director of the organization Mural. That's magnifying urban realities and affecting lives. Aisha, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hello.
Well, violent crime, of course, is near a 30-year low across the country. It has upticked in places like New York and L.A., but has increased a lot more in Chicago, more homicides in Chicago than New York and L.A. combined. What's going on?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask. We have a very strong vendetta culture here in Chicago, where it's an eye for an eye for the young people or people that are caught up in violence in the streets. And if you look at what vendetta culture looked like in Albania or in Italy, dating back to the Middle Ages up through now, it's feudal, it's family related, it's generational, and a lot of what we see here is the same thing. If you ask young people, they say that it's related to retaliation, envy, jealousy, greed. If you ask gangs or former gang members, some say that it's related to lack of structure in those systems, that there are a lot of renegades going out committing these crimes, perpetrating these crimes, whereas 20, 30 years ago, though there was still violence, there was a code and order that would relinquish some of what we see today. So it's a very complex issue, and it varies based on who you ask.
And it sounds complex. Donald Trump said that a top police officer in Chicago told him that the violence could be solved in a week with the right strategy. Then your police superintendent, Eddie Johnson, he had this to say.
If you have a magic bullet to stop the violence anywhere, not just in Chicago, but in America, then please share it with us.
So Eddie Johnson seems to agree with you that the causes are complex here and that maybe there is no way to stop it in just a week.
That's very true. It's very complex. It's going to take a lot of effort from a lot of different people to come in and really address what's happening in these communities.
But let me ask you one more question, but just before we let you go, because I want to make sure we get to a point. If the problem is not so much policy with the flow of illegal guns, I know that's part of it. There are other policies that are at play here. You're talking about cultural problems in Chicago. Lawmakers on the state or local level can do about a cultural problem in Chicago.
They need to engage with the people, engage with community groups, engage with young people more who are actually in the line of fire to understand that culture more, to build policy around what's really happening.
Aisha Jaco, co-founder and current director of Mural, magnifying urban realities and affecting lives on the violence in Chicago. 78 homicides, 400 people shot in August, the deadliest month, nearly 20 years in that city. Aisha, thank you for walking us through some of the problems there. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
So far, we know of 88 specific chemicals that have been identified.
And of those 88, how many are suspected of causing cancer?
I think the number is 11.
You could see the fear on some of their faces today as men, women, and children gathered for blood tests to determine whether those here have developed abnormalities.
I am really, really afraid. We have decided we're going to get out one way or another.
It was back in 1980, news reports told the country about a town in upstate New York where students at a school started having asthma and seizures. Their school had been built on top of a toxic waste dump. The town was Love Canal, New York. And that catastrophe led to a new federal law aimed at cleaning up toxic waste sites. It's commonly known as the Superfund. Now, nearly 40 years later, residents in Hoosick Falls, also in upstate New York, suspected their drinking water was contaminated after a higher than normal number of rare forms of cancer and thyroid disease started appearing in and around the St. Gobain factory there. The contaminant is perfluorooctanoic acid, or PFOA. It's used to make Teflon at that St. Gobain plant. It has been linked to cancers and other illnesses. On Monday, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation announced that municipal landfills in Hoosick Falls and nearby Petersburg and Berlin could potentially be designated as state Superfund sites, in addition to the St. Gobain factory, which has already received that designation. They want the federal government now to step in and help with cleanup there. But at a state Senate hearing yesterday in Hoosick Falls, residents said the state waited too long to warn them about contaminated water.
The village, municipality, New York State Department of Health, and EPA all need to be held accountable for the 18 months that could have made a difference to so many people.
That's Kathy Lingerer. She's a resident of Hoosick Falls, testifying yesterday. For more on what it will take to clean up the water in Hoosick Falls, all that contamination, and make the residents well, John Parker, director of legal programs at Riverkeeper. His organization will be testifying in Albany next week. John, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, this is a story that we've been following, John, including a conversation I had way back in February with a guy named Michael Hickey. He's a Hoosick Falls resident who tested the water himself to convince authorities that it was contaminated. Do we have a situation here where state and federal authorities have dragged their feet?
We have a problem here in that it's taken a longer time than necessary for Department of Health folks to really grapple with this, make some decisions, and move forward. I think I'd say it's not something we need to see repeated, and we need to learn the lessons of Hoosick Falls because it's not going to be the last community. In fact, there are other communities suffering from similar water contamination crisis in the state right now.
So what is the lesson? I mean, what happened here? Was this a classic case of state authorities who don't want to spend the money or tick off a powerful company dragging their feet, or is there something else at play here?
I think it's a number of factors. I think there was disagreement in the state with respect to the magnitude of the exposure and what it means to folks. That's problematic. Ultimately, when you have a situation of such ground contamination, there are laws that are triggered that are meant to be put in place to get the funding back to do these tests. I couldn't speculate about why we wouldn't want to go that route right away. It didn't happen. However, now the blood tests and the expense can be reimbursed to the state and to the taxpayers. From the local company that caused the pollution.
And so now what does it mean for the state to apply to the EPA at the federal level to get Hoosick Falls declared a Superfund site?
So the idea of managing water using the Superfund is really not the way to go. But here's simply what it means. When there is no other resort, this is the safety net. This is the last resort. You find contamination in a discrete area like around the wells here. You find that it's a threat to health, which is the part that was delayed. Then you can list it. And that's what's happened here. The EPA doesn't necessarily have to be involved. As a matter of fact, the listing is a state listing. And the listing triggers the ability to tap into what's called the Superfund, the ability to reimburse monies and get the responsible party to pay. That's what we're hoping to see here.
So there's reimbursement for people who got sick. There's reimbursement for testing. But what about cleanup? That's a whole other issue.
It is another issue, and this is the part where the idea of dealing with water contamination issues through Superfund is not smart. It takes a long time to both investigate, really assess what's there, and figure out how to clean up. These are akin to a one-off thing. This is not a standard form that you have to investigate the site. It takes a lot of time to do that. There is filtration being put in place in Hoosick. That is temporary but will become permanent. So that's a great, excellent emergency response. But getting it all out is going to take some time. It could take years.
What does it mean in this case to clean up PFOA? Is it a difficult chemical to clean up? Is it easy to clean up? And how does the EPA usually handle contamination like this?
Well, it's going to have to take a number of steps. As I indicated to you earlier, they're going to have to find the extent of the what's generally called the plume. How far did these chemicals, which rapidly move through groundwater, go? We know they're near well areas. We know that well area needs to be fully assessed. They're going to have to be pumping it out, treating that water. The interesting thing about PFOA and its sister chemical, PFOS, is that activated carbon filtration, a supercharged Brita filter, if you will, is enough to take this out. So they're going to go, they're going to have to figure out where it is in the groundwater, pump it out, treat that water so it's removed, and then they're going to have to remove what they call source materials, the actual contaminated earth itself, the dirt, the ground. It's going to have to be taken and put to a proper burial.
Complicated, it sounds like, but it also sounds like a process that's practical, that's doable. So many of these toxic waste situations, groundwater leaches everywhere, and it's almost not remediable. But this sounds like it might be able to be cleaned up.
That's the good news. The good news is they can identify the source. Some of the bad news is it actually was able to be volatilized in the air over the years. So it's a little bit more widespread than folks think. It's in the Hoosick River nearby. It's in other private drinking water wells. All of the things are going to have to be dealt with in due course. Of course, the focus has been on what the Hickey family brought to light. That is to say simply, there's a lot of these chemicals in their water. It caused health impacts to his family and others. And that's what's being dealt with right now.
John Parker, Director of Legal Programs at Riverkeeper. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Your music don't change the world.
Been locked up for so long, my head spins around.
Fuck up! Did you forget your name?
We got to fight the power of that beast!
I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised.
Your music don't change the world. Only the audience can change the world, but a good songwriter can offer a different perspective.
It's the last day today of our Summer 16 look at protest music. It's called People Get Ready, and today we're turning down the dial with one artist who sees himself more as a global voice than an American activist.
Running down a dark street, act, I got a flashlight, Nike swoosh on bare feet, Whitney Houston's crack pipe. The greatest love of all, watch me rise to watch me fall, contemplating rent is laid in ounces that I can't afford. Show my
Saul Williams has a lot of titles. They include slam poet, musician, actor. But on his latest album, which is called Martyr, Loser, King, Williams assumes the role of a futurist. It's a conceptual multimedia album, and it centers around a hacker in the resource-rich country of Burundi. The story of a techno-anarchist computer hacker fighting for his freedom is a way in for Williams to talk about police brutality, the use of power, and the abuse of power in this information age. But Saul Williams told John Hockenberry that his political roots come from a much more traditional place.
My dad was a pastor of a church in Newburgh, New York, and one of his good friends was Pete Seeger. Pete Seeger would come sing at my dad's church on a regular basis. At the time, I didn't even know who Pete Seeger was, and I'd sometimes get like a little bored, like, why is he letting this white guy sing these school songs again? Artists like Odetta would stay at my house and sing at my father's church as well. So I just grew up inspired by, you know, from that stuff to Public Enemy. Like, I really couldn't imagine why anyone would want to engage in the arts in a different way, even though I love sci-fi and fantasy and all of those things. But I could also see, you know, the social commentary that was living inside of those books and those writings. You know, it was obvious that there was something that Kurt Vonnegut wanted to say about, you know, our relationship to Haiti, you know, or something that Philip K. Dick or Octavia Butler wanted to say about American society, or George Orwell, obviously. Like, all that stuff, I always felt like, oh, yeah, we have to find a way to, like, to dig beneath the surface. And then encountering poetry, that just gave me all the keys.
Right. Well, before we talk about your new album and listen to some of your poetry, you know, Odetta, to be that close to Odetta, I've always been a fan but never seen her live. When she sings, and when she sings, like, old standards and old, down south blues tunes, I mean, she rhythmically – channels history. There's a quality of history that comes out, and then the protest part is on the top, is the last part of the message.
Yeah, Odetta was a shaman.
Run home for a long time, you may run home for a long time.
You know, Odetta was a shaman, and so, yeah, she conjured that old time religion, that old, you know, that old energy, the spirit of the songs that she would reinterpret and what have you, and you could feel that surge within you that would make you go, yeah, we have to stand up. We have to stand up. Odetta was a shaman, and so, yeah, she conjured that old-time religion, that old, you know, that old energy, the spirit of the songs that she would reinterpret and what have you, and you could feel that surge within you that would make you go, yeah, we have to stand up. We have to stand up. And to me, like, with my new album, my whole thing was just like, all I really want to do is share my biorhythm. Smile of the victor, child of the prisoner, statues of martyrs, hackers as artists. Shout out to Atlanta's first hand, second hand us. Martin Luther King is a concept album that is centered around a hacker whose screen name is Martin Luther King, who lives in a fictitious village in the country of Burundi, which is part of the region, the Great Lakes region, where, well, one of the things that is mined from those regions is cobalt or coltan. And coltan is the precious stone that's in all of our smartphones and laptops. It circulates power through small circuitry boards. I started thinking about the actual distribution of power, the distribution of power, like the distribution of wealth and all of the layers between and the intersectional realities, the whistleblowers, the punishment that's being doled out to the whistleblowers, the desire for greater and greater control versus net neutrality.
Hacking the dietary sustenance, tradition versus health. The comfort compliance, hacking to the rebellious gene, hacking to doctrine, capitalism, relation of free labor and slavery, hacking to the history of the bank, is beating the odds of Iraq to join the winning team,
hacking to desperation and loneliness, the history of community in the marketplace, hacking to land rights and ownership, hacking to business law, proprietorship, hacking to ambition and greed, hacking to forms of government, systems of control, the relation to suffering and sufferance, hacking to faith and morality, the treatment of one faith towards another, hacking to masculinity, femininity, sexuality, what is taught, what is felt, what is learned, what is shared. That's a poem from the project that's called Colton as Cotton.
That's great stuff. Do you worry that it gets pointy-headed and academic, or is it something for audiences to stand up and engage and march over? I mean, you've done Occupy Wall Street. You've done the whole
thing. Well, what I trust is the cycle, is our own cycle of interest. Poetry gets popular in this country about every 20 years. You wouldn't have, like, the hippie movement of the 60s if it weren't for the beat poets of the 50s. You know, you think of, like, the Harlem Renaissance and all the great writers that came from the 30s and 40s that led up to the 50s. You think of the Black Arts movement in the 70s that led to the Black Power movement. And just these cycles of interest in peripheral arts going center.
Was Slam on that 20-year cycle?
Yeah, Slam was on that cycle. So you go from, what, 77 to 97. And suddenly you have the slam poetry movement opening the doors for a new generation to say, you know what? I want to write a poem. Like, I think the best way I can express everything that I'm feeling. And what are you feeling? You're feeling entitled to something. You're feeling like, why in the world is this stuff that's so obviously wrong still going on?
Who's your audience right now? Who's your audience that you would aspire to mobilize if you had an arena, if you had a stage, if there was a place right now?
The world stage. I'm sorry not to be more specific, but these realities are spread out across the globe. I've, you know, recently, my summer began with me visiting a refugee camp outside of Paris, where I met refugees from Syria to Sudan to Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Ethiopia, all telling me these crazy stories of how they had arrived in these, you know, in this tent city. We have the capacity to connect the dots between how we are disenfranchised here, how they are disenfranchised there. In fact, it's all related. And if we are smart enough to outsmart the powers that be, then we can really shift the times that we're living in.
Saul Williams, thanks so much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for talking to me.
Saul Williams is a singer-songwriter, poet, and activist. His latest album, Martyr, Loser, King. It's out now. And you heard Saul Williams talking to John Hockenberry there. You can go to thetakeaway.org/protestmusic to listen back to all of the artists we've heard from during this summer of 16. You got Annie DeFranco, Heems, Billy Bragg, a lot more, all part of our People Get Ready series, the protest music of this summer of 16. You can also follow me on Twitter during this election season. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.